RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
I'm with the graphic designer Arnold Schwartzman, who was on a visit to London from his home in Los Angeles. He was here to be welcomed into the faculty of Royal Designers for Industry. The early part of Arnold's career started in the 1960s, working for a regional television station where he was responsible for all of the on-screen graphics, still at that time transmitted in glorious black and white. Later, he joined the London-based network TV station Associated Diffusion. Here, he worked alongside some serious design competition. Arnold rose to the occasion and quickly found that he had a talent for graphically summarizing a television program or drama through simple, striking imagery and typography, and he rapidly made an impact with his distinctive approach. After many years producing a mix of editorial, illustration and motion graphics, including a short-lived association with Terence Conran, he upsticks and moved to Los Angeles, where he worked for the legendary feature film title designer Saul Bass. It was here that the germ of an idea to direct a full-length documentary about the Holocaust was planted. Encouraged by Bass, Arnold left the company and embarked on what became a labor of love. And in 1982, the fruits of that labor, his film Genocide, was awarded an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. And still, 25 years on, it has a profound and moving impact. Arnold, I want to start off with an observation rather than a question, and it's simply this, and I wouldn't normally mention age in these interviews, but it just so happens that your birth, 1936, was the very year that the Faculty of Royal Designers for Industry was created, so it's a kind of a rather fitting moment, as these are fairly new, these podcasts. Anyway, I want to start off by asking you about your childhood. I know that it was set against the drama of the Second World War, and indeed your home had a direct hit during the Blitz, which meant, of course, that you then moved around quite a lot, along with many other children at that time. You were evacuated, and you had a fairly disruptive education, from what I can understand. And what I'd like to ask you is, going to, I think it was 8 different schools, what kind of effect that had on you, sort of academically?
Well, it was essentially non-academic at all. I actually taught myself to read when I was about 9 years old by looking at ads on buses. I don't know how I did this, but in a way, it was a fortunate effect on me that going from school to school, I was 4 years old, and they put me into a village school with 16-year-olds, so the teacher would ply me with cigarette carts. So I grew up in a very visual world rather than a literary one. And my father used to get regularly Lilliput, the little magazine that was current during the Second World War. And I just couldn't read the short articles, but I just loved the juxtaposition of opposing pages. There'd be an image, say, of a hippopotamus on one side and a look-alike racing car on the other, and so on. And that visual philosophy has stayed with me all these years. And also, my father was a waiter at the Savoy Hotel next door to the Royal Society of Arts. And the American officers during the war used to give him the Saturday Evening Post and Life magazine, and so and of course we have Picture Post and Everybody's and Illustrated magazine, so it was a very visual upbringing, I confess now, and people won't believe me, that the only book I've ever read is Alice in Wonderland. I have read scripts, obviously, for making films and so on. I just don't have the concentration to actually sit down and read a book. And one of my dear friends is Len Dayton, the author, and he always gives me copies of his book when they come out. And I remember one recently, he said, if you don't read this one, you don't get dinner. And so
it's very visual. In fact, that seems to be the case with certainly many designers that I've met, that they were certainly designers in the 50s, and I know your schooling was a little earlier, but I don't think it changed that much, that anyone that had a kind of a creative leaning, i.e. illustrated or drew a lot, were siphoned off really as sort of pretty, well, they would be regarded as dunces often. They would be doing, you know, gardening club and woodwork and things like that, opposed to the high flyers who were, you know, the mathematicians and so on. And I think that it's now recognized, and many, many designers I've met now know that they have dyslexia, and that's another common phenomenon within the creative field. Anyway, what I want to move on to now is you obviously had you were visually fed, and I know the feeling when you kind of absorb, literally like a vacuum cleaner, absorb visual things, because and those American newspapers and magazines that you referred to often had supplements which we never had in the 50s here. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had color supplements with the comic strips and so on. So I can well imagine you being enthralled by that. You then, obviously, at some point, you started to feel that you'd like to exploit this ability that you had of drawing and being visually literate. And so just tell me about how you first became aware of graphic design, or probably as it was known then, commercial art. How did you get on that sort of career path, and college particularly?
Well, I think the timing was perfect in a way. I left school at 15, and it was the year of the Festival of Britain, and my parents took me to the South Bank, and it was it was a real inspiration. It was amazing. I just loved it, and at the same time, after the Second World War, my parents bought a small hotel down in Cliftonville, Margate, one of the guests that stayed there were the parents of Abram Games, and so Abram would come down on the weekends to see them, and of course he was my first big hero, and I got to meet him. He was very severe, it encouraged me to go to art school, and in fact I was extremely shy, and my father, who loves to draw lettering, sort of Mickey Mouse type sort of shapes and so on, and he, in order to encourage me, actually enrolled in evening classes at the local art school in Margate, the Thanet School of Arts and Craft. And I remember him, in fact, my tutor recently recalled how we had this very small desk, rather like in a primary school, and my father sitting next to me and doing these bits of artwork.
So your father was doing lettering. He was
He just loved the use of doing it. I don't think I would have had the courage to come on my own. So
yes.
After the first term, he backed out. But in order I went. And at the time, I never thought what a great thing it was.
It's a wonderful thing.
And at the same time, going back a few years, my father bought me a Pathé 9.8
Cine
projector, and hand crank one. Yeah. And I just loved that.
Yes.
And so that gave me a sort of passion for film as well. I just loved putting things in reverse, and so I remember there was one particular cartoon, I don't know if it was Mickey Mouse or whatever, where the coconuts fell off the palm tree, bouncing off somebody's head, and I reversed it, and the coconuts go back up in the tree, and I always remember that.
That's
be able to play with
it. Very interesting, these little things that you get that have a profound effect on your life. I can quite see now that you, because I remember certainly, again, in the 50s, that those little projectors were very common, and you could get these little spools of film have great fun with them.
Oh, it was wonderful.
In your case, it had a much more a deeper impact. Mm. So you went off to art school, and you were at two, in fact, weren't you? What was the second one like?
I first took my what they called in those days the intermediate exam at Thanet School of Art and Class. And that was a 2-year course, and then I sort of graduated onto Canterbury, where one took the National Diploma in Design, and I was there for 2 or 3 years. I can't remember now, maybe 2 years, and there was a sort of magic thing about Canterbury. I knew that was the place that the next step up, and I just loved it when I went there. You know, they had a print shop and various methods of printing and so on. And I really enjoy that. Although, in terms of the acceptance of me, wasn't too great, mainly because the tutor, the head of the department, was a words man and not a visual man. He was a fourth form or sixth form master previously. And so he did appreciate me and virtually, well, almost failed me in my NDD. And it was only that I had a very forceful mother. I think he was scared of her. But I actually got through. Whereas one of my best friends, whose parents were, you know, not quite as aggressive as my mother, and he failed him after he went through the whole course, and he was a brilliant illustrator. And he got his revenge. He then was accepted by the Royal College after that. So,
So after you get your diploma, like so many other, you know, young teenagers of that period, you have to do your national service, which must have been, I assume, very frustrating because you spent, you know, several years studying, you know, what your kind of vocation, and then suddenly you're whisked off to national service. So what was that like, and what did you do? Were you able to use any of this creative talent in service?
Yeah, interesting enough, prior to going out there, I had one of my regular visits to Abram Games' home in 41 The Vale. I still remember that, in Golders Green. And he said, well, you know, when I was in the army, I produced all this work. He said, now it's your great opportunity to do the same. I said, well, I didn't think it'd be quite the same, but I'd do my best. And so I was first, after basic training, they put me in the educational corps, and of course realised I wasn't that educated, and then transferred me to the infantry. The reason was that although the NDD was a sort of equivalent to some sort of teaching degree, I didn't have 11 plus, and there was some army regulation about you had to have 11 plus as a minimal. So one day they sat me in this class if I dare say, semi-literate. So, you know, I was in a rural regiment where most of them were farm boys, and most of them couldn't. I could talk. I wasn't much more literate than they were. But anyway, I sat there with my education corps patches on my uniform, and everybody stood up, thinking I was the teacher. And anyway, it was quite embarrassing when the tutor came in. He said, "Well, you don't ever go through this." And sent me back to my room. Anyway, they then transferred me to the Royal West Kents, who in turn sent me on to the Royal Sussex Regiment in Minden in Germany, where I was there only for a few weeks before we were shipped off to Korea. And there came my very first, let's say, professional job outside of art school. They said, you're an artist, report to the ship's bosun. It was a six-week journey from Southampton to Korea. And I reported to the ship's bosun, and he said, I'd like to retouch the lettering on the lifebelts. And I said, oh, great. And he gave me a deck where nobody else was allowed to go on above the actual bridge of the ship. And so I was excused all duties. Every day I go up there with these lifebelts. And I didn't quite like the letter form. And I thought, I'm doing it in gilt. And it was a white background and red lettering, and so I thought, I'll paint it right. I won't retouch them. I painted the life belt white, and of course it dried quickly going through the Indian Ocean. And I then carefully painted the red lettering Empire Orwell. By the time we got to about Hong Kong, the ship's bosun came up to see how I was getting on. He said, oh my God, what have you done? I said, well, you don't write my lettering? And he said, yes, he said, but I didn't tell you to paint the whole thing white. He said, you know, that's lead paint. He said, they will lose their buoyancy, and when we get back, the border trade will just have to dump all the lifebelts. It was like 100 of them. So, anyway, so that was my first experience.
then you return, finally, after doing your 2 years, and you join a regional television station, Southern Television, and you were the only graphic designer responsible for all the on-screen graphics at the time, and I know that was a fairly short-lived experience because you I think within a year had graduated from Southern Television to London to join Associated Radio Fusion, which was a networked
channel and a very, at the time, certainly very innovative. And it seemed to me, looking at your body of work at that time, it was a real blossoming for you because, from what I understand, there was quite a lot of interesting people working there, certainly some strong competition, which is always, I think, for any designer, a good thing because it kind of ups the ante. And you seem to find your feet because there's a remarkable array of on-screen graphics in a variety of amazing styles looking at your work, from stop-frame animation collages for Peter and the Wolf, which looks a remarkable piece of work. And of course, everything was in black and white then. So I wondered, did you actually produce that piece in colour or in grey tones?
No,
it would have been lovely to see it.
It was all done with tissue paper, coloured tissue. And if I can be brief about it was an interesting story about that. There must have been about 100 different captions. And it was a sort of double act between Richard Attenborough and myself. He narrated it. They were cut between seeing Lord Attenborough, Dickie Attenborough, as he was then, and my captions. The director, who I can't remember his name now, but he called the morning of the rehearsal and the day of transmission, in fact, and said, could I do one more illustration to fill some gap? I don't know why they couldn't cut back. So I said, fine. And he said, and then bring all of them with you in a cab to the Hackney Empire. I think it was Hackney Empire. I still to this day don't remember which one. Anyway, I got in the cab and I went to the wrong empire. It was either Finsbury Park and I got there and the place was totally closed and there was no mobile phones in those days. I couldn't find a telephone booth. I couldn't get a taxi. Finally, I called the Reedy Fusion and they said, where are you? I said, well, I'm totally lost. They said, oh, waiting. There's the Royal Ballet and there's the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and all these people, they can't get on for some reason without you. Anyway, I finally managed to get a cab and arrived there very late. The floor manager grabbed everything from me and it then all worked out well, and in fact, Dickie Attenborough took me home in his car and back to the West End that evening. Anyway, so yes, in fact, I used to work in colour, and of course, it transmitted in black and white.
And tell me about some of the other people that were working at that television station at the time.
There were some great people, and what I loved about it was the fact that. There was about nine of us, and there were senior, the union grades was a graphic designer and graphic artist, and the difference was the money. Basically, we all did the same work, and finally, I wasn't going to be promoted to a designer until one of them left, because they could only have so many. But there was Sidney King, who I thought was fantastic, wonderful illustrator and designer. Maureen Roffey, the wife of Bernard Lodge, another wonderful illustrator. There were so many great people there, great lettering artists, and we all got on so well.
And you worked, sorry to interrupt, certainly looking at some of that work, for example, I think the Dostoevsky sequence, you worked alongside Don McCullen, who I think shot the images for that.
So. Don actually worked a lot for me at that time, and I remember he was such a daring young man. The set we had was, I think, one of the largest sets ever built, and it was at the new Studio 5 at Wembley, which at that time was the largest studio in the world. And we went up in the gantry, and he said, look, you hold my ankles, because I wanted a shot right down the centre. And I actually held his ankles out in the middle. I mean, he just trusted me and shot. Because he wanted to get out into the middle of the thing. But Don, we worked together quite a bit, and I remember I used to illustrate for Man About Town, when it became Town, whatever, for Tom Wolsey. And when Tom moved to Queen magazine, I remember one day the door opening of Tom's office, I was waiting outside to deliver an illustration. And suddenly, it was rather like a film fun strip. Out came Don clutching his behind and a little foot behind kicking him out. And it was actually Tom Wolsey kicking Don. And Don said, oh, he's in a bad mood today. He said, and in fact, David King, who was his assistant one time, said, oh, something else told me that the only person that the people that Tom Wolsey get on with was David King and myself. But it's interesting. But he was a wonderful art director.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing about your period, which is quite a long period, really, it's spanned, 7 years, it seemed to me. It was 59 to 66.
At the Fusion.
Yes.
I loved it so much, but I was terribly ambitious, and at that time, wonderful things were coming out of New York in graphics and in advertising.
Yes.
And I thought I would go and check it out.
Well, I think before you get onto that, I think you just touched on something that I think is very interesting. Around about that time in America, I think CBS, particularly with Lou Dorsman, was producing some fantastic work. Inspirational work. Mm. And looking at, again, back at your Associated Reader Fusion days, you seemed to graduate very quickly. You not only were designing the on-screen stuff and logos for Ready, Steady, Go, which actually, looking at it again, looks remarkably fresh. You know, it really does. You see things like that. But you also beginning to film now, film sequences, and right. I think the Ready, Steady, Go title sequence, which you filmed. So you were graduating from stop frame animation through to the moving image. So just tell me a little about that.
Well, it just seemed a natural move, really. First it was stills, and then the animation, and the live action seemed to come quite naturally. But to me, it was all graphics. I mean, I never see film in a way as a separate thing. People often ask me, what do I prefer? I must say, these days, I'll tell you straight away, it's graphics. Maybe because I just don't like the misery of being on a cold winter's day in some remote, far-off country with no food or hot water, whatever. Whereas I like sitting behind my desk coming up with design concepts. But going back to that, yes, the film side I love. But it was really an extra branch of my graphics.
Yeah. So then after that very fruitful period, you decide to explore advertising, and you joined in 66 Irwin Wasey Advertising, which at the time had a very good creative reputation. Some very good people.
I disagree with you.
Do you think so?
They were seen as being probably one of the most successful agencies at that time. And their client relationship was wonderful. But they weren't really seen as a particularly creative agency. And what in fact happened, if I can backtrack slightly back to my visit to New York, I went there for that 3-week trip, and on my own, not with my wife and daughter. And I stayed with a friend who was a graphic designer. He was in the United States Army. We met in Korea. And I stayed with him in New Jersey. And so I went to meet all my heroes, really. I wasn't particularly looking for a job, I was just checking it out. And I saw Milton Glaser and Seymour Quest and Herb Lou Barron. And of course, I went to CBS and I saw the head of one of the print divisions. And I showed him my portfolio. He says, it's great. He said, have you shown it to Dorsman? I said, well, I'm not looking for a job and I don't want to bother the man. He's like, too important. He said, and he picked up the phone and he said, I've got this limey here, you've got to see his work. So he said, could I come 9 o'clock the next morning, and which I did. And Lou was actually looking at two little monitors on his desk, and there was one of the early moon or space rockets, and he was actually turning my portfolio but really looking at the screen. Well, he was looking backwards and forwards, and I can see, I thought it wasn't very interesting. He said, well, I know most of your work. He said, when can you start? I said, well, I'm not looking for a job. I said, oh, come on. He said, I'll give you a Manhattan office and a free telephone. I said, but I've got a wife and daughter back home. I'm only here for you. Oh, come on. So the next thing I know, within minutes, I'm sitting at a desk, and this production man comes in, who I still keep in touch with, and he gives me a full-page ad of Jackie Gleason Show to design. And it was amazing. I just loved it. And I called my friend in New Jersey. He said, well, did you see Dawson? I said, yes. I said, but I can't talk. I'll tell you this evening. I'm working. He said, what do you mean you're working? I'll tell you this evening. so I had a job getting away from there, I went to his secretary a few days before I was due to go back home. Her name was Terry Kerner, I still remember. And I said to her, you know, I've got a wife and child back home. I believe that. She says, Lou knows that. He knows that. He says, but he wants you to stay. I said, I know that. But anyway, I sort of made an absolute promise I would return one day. But at that time, I did get a very good offer from Notre Dame Bonebar.
In New York.
In New York.
That was the
hottest thing. Sorry, but anyway, when I got back to the UK, prior to going out there, I saw an ad in the paper for some creative chief they wanted at Waze's. But in fact, it was when I got there, they really wanted a copy man. Well, I said, well, no, I'm not a copy man. But they liked my work so much, they gave me this rather fantastic title of concept planning executive. And I could take any of their prime accounts, like Coca-Cola and Philips and so on, and do whatever I like with it. And it was fantastic. And they just loved me. It was amazing. The chairman, it was so funny, he gave me a fantastic office. And he used to come in, and he had this, he looked like Alfred Hitchcock, and would come in sort of whistling. And it always unnerved me. And he'd look at the floor and say, good carpet. And he'd look at the curtains and say, not many people got carpet and curtains here. And I said, well, what are you trying to tell me? But the nice thing was that I went off on location once for Coca-Cola to, where was it? In the Caribbean. When I got back, I went down to accounts to get my expenses, and the accounts lady said, oh, she said, I love your work. I said, well, how does a lady in the accounts department know my work? She says, well, while you're away, Mr. Reader, that's the chairman, he said he gave a presentation of your work to the whole agency, which was one he never said anything to me about that. Anyway, moving on. So that's, but going back to the creative bit, I think that was the smart part of it, I suppose, seeing that perhaps I could instill some creative spark. And what in fact happened, the moment I came on board, I can't remember his name now, but the head of the whole of Interpublic, which Waze's were part of, you know, McCann Erickson and so on, because the fact he learned that I was at CBS for a few weeks, I don't know, maybe he thought I was there for years, suddenly said, I want this man to run the account. We're getting this big account in Germany for Glücksklee, which is the carnation milk instant breakfast. And so I suddenly became sort of a star at the agency. And I was there for about 3 or 3.5 years. And I really loved it. And they liked me a lot. And they were very disappointed when Terence Conran dragged me away.
Yes, and that brings us on to 1969. And you left to join the Conran Design Group as a director, creative director, and that turned out to be very short-lived.
It was. The first time, I should have realised then, that I'm not somebody who likes managing other people. I just like to do my own thing. In terms of a film crew, that's fine, but having a bunch of designers to and not be able to do your own thing is rather frustrating. And I was only with Terence for about 10 months, and I left and went on my own. And I think then I went into, I suppose, into a what did Winston Churchill call it?
The wilderness.
The wilderness years.
Well, you say that, but I mean, it was quite a long period. This is, I think, probably 8 years that you were freelance with your own company.
Yeah, but
doing virtually, it seemed to me at that time, you would take on your illustration seemed to become more apparent, and certainly you established a very recognisable style, which, again, reviewing it, it still looks terrific.
Thank you.
You did a lot of editorial design as well, you know,
That's true.
Sunday Times.
Yeah, sorry, you're absolutely right. Maybe I'm thinking on the side, I made this mistake of hooking up with a very good creative film production company. But I didn't think I was a very good commercial director. And yes, of course, I did two special supplements for the Sunday Times, Eureka.
The Facts of Life.
The Facts of Life and Eureka, The History of Invention.
And and that one in particular, The History of Invention, you actually commissioned quite a large number of other illustrators.
Oh, yeah.
And in both of them.
A lot of American ones, like I was discussing yesterday with a friend of mine, Burton Silverman, Paul Davis,
yeah.
Milton Glaser, Seymour Quest,
which I mean, and again, you know, it's very rare to see that happen today. I mean, that kind of level of commitment to a project. I mean, obviously very famous for the Sunday Times, who were trailblazers in doing that sort of thing.
Except that, you know, what was really great, that Michael Rand would give me total freedom.
Yeah.
And it was great with that. And he has often used significant people outside. Not forgetting the fact I use significant British designers as well. Mm. But, yeah, that was most fortunate. I had that opportunity to do that, and the same with the Fact of Life. Yeah.
Yes, and then so, you know, around about that time, or a little later, you have this connection with Saul Bass, who invites you to go to in 78 to go over to Los Angeles. And then offers you a position at his own company. What was that position? What did you?
I was again the director of design, or design director it was called. And again, it was rather strange, sort of serendipity. All these how these things happen. I had designed a charity cookbook for the White Elephant Club. And
I think if I remember, you commissioned a whole range of people for that too.
It was
one of the first books where it seemed to me that I remember at the time, because I remember lusting after that book because everybody seemed to be in it. Mm-hmm. The idea of taking a recipe and then attaching it to a designer, and I seem to remember probably Bass actually did a piece for us. So maybe that's how your connection. But sorry,
That in fact was in connection. Interesting enough that without fail, as you may know, that most designers and photographers. More designs than the photographers and the illustrators are most generous in donating their time to such projects. And it was for underprivileged children. And whoever I asked readily agreed, and I would give them a choice of recipes, and of course the recipes were running out. And I wrote to Saul Bass, who I'd only met once at some talk he'd given, and not heard back from him, and I thought, well, he's a busy man, and so on. And I was one day actually in a photographer's studio in London. We were actually shooting something for Philips, their 50th anniversary calendar. And his assistant came in and said, oh, there's a call for Arnold from Saul Bass. And he said, oh, I'm impressed. I said, so am I. Anyway, it was Saul on the phone. He said, I'm in London, and I'm making my first feature length film, Phase 4, and I just came out of the tunnel of making this film, and if it's not too late, I'd love to do your illustration. I said, fantastic. He said, let's meet tonight at my hotel, which is Blake's, and have dinner. And so I met with him, and we were discussing it, and funny enough, while I was sitting there, across the room was Donald Silverstein, the photographer. And he came over and he said, please forgive me, he said, Arnold, but it's all best with you. He said, will you introduce me? So anyway, I introduced him, and it worked out well because Saul came out with this idea of having his own logo, which is a fish with his initials, his signature, like a fishing line. And we had two plates. He was going to have a real bass on the bottom one and the signature on the top. But we needed a photograph of it somewhere. So I said, one moment, I asked Donald, I said, can we use your studio and your equipment? He said, yeah. So we shot it there. And the White Elephant Club, of course, supplied the sea bass, of course, Saul being very picky. I don't know, we entered the restaurant of sea bass. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed the whole point. It's the fact I said to Saul, I've kept one recipe back just in case you do it. It was sea bass. He said, perfect. And so that's...
Oh, that's very nice. That's how it, so anyway, you find yourself working suddenly for Saul Bass now. And what was that experience like? Because, you know, Bass, is a giant, sadly no longer with us, but of, you know, one of the original sort of creators of film titles. So I would have thought, you know, the old saying of little acorns can't grow under large oak trees. I mean, it must have been quite difficult.
It was. For several reasons. One, that I was always in great awe of him, and I was frightened to make a move on my own. basically, I think that was the real problem. But what was interesting was that he was away when I first joined him. He was away for several weeks working on the new Exxon account that we were designing, and I, in fact, was away all over America and Canada. But the first job I had there was designing a poster for the Girl Scouts of America. And when he came back, he said, gee, that's wonderful. I'm going to put that on the hall, he said. And it had the most prominent place in the hall. He was lovely. He was just a warm person. But I just realized it. Mm. And again, I had to look after not many designers. I can't remember how many we had there. I didn't feel very comfortable there, and I really felt I was missing the UK, London particularly, and it was the fact that my wife liked it so much there. I thought, well, maybe it's very difficult, you know, you're virtually unknown in a new town, so to speak, in Los Angeles, and so one would have to sort of start from fresh to find clients. Actually, Walter Landau up in San Francisco heard I was leaving and offered me quite a good position there. And I went up to see him, but I decided that I really must never take on the job again running a design group.
Well, then I think probably for you anyway, one of the most important things happened to you, and that was getting involved in the what started out to be a multi-projector, slide-projector presentation of the Holocaust, which was to become genocide. And that subsequently was so successful that you transferred the whole thing onto celluloid and re-edited and so forth and pulled in Elizabeth Taylor and Orson Welles to narrate it. And it seemed to me, looking at that film, as I did recently, that it was a real labour of love. And what I could see in it was the sheer volume of research that appeared to go into that film, much of which must have been incredibly harrowing, because the film, as it stands now, is incredibly moving. And of course, after that long slog, which I think it was quite a long period of time putting that whole thing together.
There was a 10-year gap when the Simon Wiesenthal Center, who I made Genocide for, called me back. I said I would never make another film for them again. But 10 years later, I just happened to bump into the head of the organization, and he said, I have a perfect project for you. And I made a film in Eastern Europe, going all around Romania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and these little villages. And that was great fun. I had quite a large crew. And again, not much food and not hot water and all that stuff, but it was fun. And so that was 10 years. But I think it was like the following year, I then made The Long Sobbing, which I actually changed the title to Liberation, because not many people could understand the significance of the long sobs, which was the sort of secret code to the resistance in France when D-Day was going to happen. They were all feature-length films I'd made for the reasonable thing.
Genocide went on, as I said, to win an Oscar. I just wanted to, very briefly, because I think an interesting character in his own right, and that was working with Orson Welles. What was that like?
Oh, that was fantastic, actually. Orson readily agreed to narrate it, and I sent him the script, and he was very pleased with it. I mean, after hearing that horrendous tape that got around for many years about him.
I know the one.
With Bird's Eye Peas.
Which is wonderful.
With J. Walter Thompson. But, so I was sort of rather terrified that he'd eat me alive. But anyway, we would fix the time, and he had his own little studio quite near where I lived in Hollywood. And I'd go down there, and his assistant would say, "Oh, I'm sorry, Orson's at the dentist today," and then he was in his pajamas or something. I know there was some excuse, and this went on for 6 months, and I thought, God, I'm never going. I got to a point where I really needed the narration. And finally, one day, it was on a daily basis on my way to my studio, which was down in Venice, California, I got a call from his assistant and says, "Orson's here." So my wife and I rushed down to the studio, and he was greeted us warmly. And I went up in the control room, and he sat him down. He had this enormous chair that he had, his personal chair. He sat down, and I said to him, "Now, I'm not going to attempt to direct you much. I'm sure you're going to do a great job." And his face lit up. He knew that hopefully he wasn't getting in trouble for me. But I said, "You know, there are a lot of foreign pronunciations in there. If you have a problem with them, you know, just stop and I'll give them to you." So he said, "Fine." Anyway, he started, and it was beautiful. And he would sometimes stop and read a phrase and then read it again in a totally different way. In fact, in the end, I was really confused mesmerizing. Which one to choose. That everyone was excellent, and they put a twist on each one. But also about 3 minutes, suddenly he stopped and he like exploded. He went all red in the face and jumped out of this chair. I mean, all, I don't know, 26 stone or more of him. And he says, "Outrageous, unforgivable." Oh God, what have I done? I mean, what was it in the script that he didn't like? So I was so desperate, I thought it's taken me 6 months to get him into the studio and now I'm going to lose him. And he picked up his jacket, which was on the back of the chair, put it on and went to the door of the booth. So I rushed out of the control room and I literally blocked him. I mean, he was an enormous man standing in front of me. But I was so anxious that I mustn't let him go. And he says, "Unforgivable." And he says, "Where's Marty?" And Marty was his assistant. "Where's Marty?" So Marty said, "What's the problem, Orson?" He said, "You didn't turn the air conditioning off." And he says, "I can hear it." So I said, I didn't hear it. So I said, "Oh, don't worry." I said, "I can filter it out." "No, you won't be able to filter it out." Oh, God, what I said. Anyway, this went on for several minutes. And finally, he calmed down. But the heavy breathing, "Oh," he says, "Marty, get me a coffee." And he sat down. He says, "All right." He says, "I'll carry on." He says, "But I'm not going back to the top." I said, "No, that's fine. I can assure you." And I thought, "Oh, no, I'm going to say I filtered it out again." Anyway, he sat down and had some coffee, and then started again. Then he stopped. "Oh, what is it this time?" He says, "Marty, there are people talking outside. Tell them to shut up." There was nobody else there. I don't know what it was. Anyway, finally, he went. He then continued, and he did a magnificent reading. You know, it was like,
which is actually very beautiful. And
an hour. It was amazing. And then afterwards, it was so funny. My wife and I went into the booth. And he says, "Congratulations, a wonderful script," he said. And he said to Isolde, he said, "Oh, please forgive me, my dear, for not getting up, but I have a very bad back." But I mean, he shot out that chair early on. And I got it all on tape. Marty has kept the tape running. But he was very charming. And when it came to the premiere, which was at the Kennedy Center in Washington, Elizabeth Taylor turned up. And Frank Sinatra was the master of ceremonies for the evening. But Orson said he had a high temperature, whether it's true or not. But he found it very difficult to travel. Yeah.
Yes. And of course, you win an Oscar for that, which must have been a very magical moment to stand up there with an Oscar in your hand.
Well, it was one of those sort of out-of-body experiences because, you know, as a child, one goes to the cinema in England and you look up at the screen and you see Gregory Peck and Danny Kaye, all your favourite people. And now I was up there looking down, and there was Danny Kaye and Gregory Peck and Barbara Stanwyck and Loretta Young and all these stars that you always revered as a child looking up at you. Yes. And it is a sort of unreal experience.
And where do you keep your Oscar?
I keep it on a bookcase. When I first got it, I was rather uncool about it. I happened to be coming to England on to London on a project the following day, and I had it in a Harrods carrier bag. And everywhere I went, I was suddenly pull it out of the bag, put it on the table. But I don't do that anymore.
So after that, you then pick up another very important job, which is as design director of the LA Olympics, which produced a whole mass of work, which must have been quite a project to coordinate.
I really love that. I mean, what was so interesting about that was the fact that, unlike the ambitions of London, I suppose, the city refused to spend one penny on the games. It all had to come from the private sector. And so we had a fantastic president, Peter Uberoff, a very bright businessman, and he managed to get all these sponsors in to pay for the games. But we didn't build one facility. The only new facilities was the 7-Eleven velodrome, the cycling velodrome, and the McDonald's swimming stadium. I think that's all there was. And all the other structures were very temporary, but beautifully done by the architect John Jurdy and Deborah Sussman and her company, Sussman Fraser, and did these bright, what we originally called festive mariachi colours, but we end up calling it festive federalism. But they really did the major part of it. And I actually, again, got the job by accident, in a way. What happened was that I employed a small graphic studio to do paste-ups and stuff when I was making Genocide. And afterwards, the principal of this studio went to high school with the head of PR at the Olympic Committee. I was over here working on a project. I got a call one day from him, as I just won the Academy Award that year. I was like the choice, I suppose. And he said, we need to make a film on the history of the Olympic Games. I said, oh, that's wonderful. It's a subject I'd love to do. I said, but I'm here for another 3 weeks. Can you wait? He said, yeah, fine. And I went back, and I spent a lot of time with them discussing it, and it was about to happen. And then Peter Uberoff, again being a great businessman, did a deal with South America, and in exchange with, I can't remember if it was NBC or ABC, for that territory or whatever, they would make the film for nothing. So I lost a job, but because of our relationship, and I used to meet with them on a daily basis, and they enjoyed my design and like getting on with me, Peter said, how would you like to be our director of design? I said, fine. And so it came very easily. And prior to that, they had a competition for a symbol, and they actually asked Saul Bass, and he said, no, I don't go in for competitions. He said, that's for art students. And that was the principle we had. Although he would have loved to have done it, but there you are.
So, I mean, now, in the ensuing years, in LA, you've been involved for many years with the with BAFTA, the LA chapter of BAFTA, you as their chairman.
Right.
And also, I think you still continue, or maybe not now, but you were chairman of the documentary committee for the Academy of Motion Pictures. Does that still continue?
No. Well, in fact, I feel very proud of the fact that during my tenure as chairman, I decided about time that the Academy had a documentary branch, you know, actors, film directors, producers, screenwriters, they all have their own branch. But there's never been a documentary branch. I was a member at large, so they lump all those people that don't have a branch into that. And they've been giving awards for documentaries for 60 years. And again, the time was right. All the presidents of the Academy that I've worked with have all been great, but this one was really fantastic. And prior to this, we had a lot of trouble. People will often say in the media and so on that, you know, why didn't so-and-so documentary win or get nominated? The judgment must, there must be something wrong in the system. And I think basically what it was, in all the other branches, you're judged by your peers first, and they nominate the film, and then it goes on to the whole academy. And so I met with the president and discussed it. He said, well, why don't you put a proposal together? And along with two of my colleagues on the executive committee, I put this proposal together and presented it to committee after committee, and then finally went to the Board of Governors, and we were actually given a branch. And so once we had a branch, then the members of the branch had to vote for the governor of the branch, and although I was nominated five times now, I've never been made a governor. In fact, this year, I was nominated yet again, and I turned it down. And this year also, Michael Apted, who's now the current chairman, called me the other day and said, Arnold, you know, you're the longest standing person on the executive committee ever, which is against the rules. I said, would you mind standing down for a year? I said, I was going to volunteer anyway. So I'm no longer on the executive committee this year, and they said, I'll be back next year. But I'm very proud of that achievement. And since we've had a branch, there's very little criticism of our judgment.
And also, between all this, you have produced, I think, 9 or 10 books now.
Just on my 11th.
11th, okay, your 11th book. And looking through those books, you know, clearly you're a very talented photographer as well.
Thank you.
And your visual eyes still as sharp as ever. What are you working on now? What projects?
I just delivered last week to my publisher a book which I'm particularly proud of London Art Deco. And it follows up with my book on Los Angeles Art Deco, which was called Deco Landmarks. I've never done two books on the same subject. It's the first time, and I think it's something to do with the fact I'm Art Deco myself, and that I just love that period. In fact, yesterday I was in Cambridge, and of course you wouldn't expect to find anything. I found two wonderful examples of Art Deco in Cambridge. They will be out in May of 2007. Yeah.
Well, on that note, Arnold Torchman, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.